Why are you here? I don't mean you always come here and therefore you come every Sunday, irrespective of things, except bad health might keep you away. But why are you here on the earth? Where did you come from? This isn't a biological answer, of course, but you all know your forebears, and people take a big interest, don't they, in their forebears and find out various things. Only this week, my oldest daughter found out about me and the way that we live at Ripon now for the last 4 years. And my grandfather used to be at Ripon in the First World War, and she found out he got a medal. I didn't know that. I come from a military family, I knew that. My father was a conscientious objector, one of five boys that was, but it's interesting. And also, my daughters found out about my great-grandfather and what he did and so on. But it really is interesting. Not that it affects me much, because I am unique, like all of you. The point is, why are you here? Why are we here? Look at the bigger past on Earth. Why are we here on Earth? Why is the Earth here? Where did we come from? Where are we going? Where are you going in life? Yesterday, I was at Birmingham for a meeting of Christadelphians to do with the Christadelphians' care homes, and it was remarked on how some of those that were with us a year or two ago no longer with us. They're asleep in the earth. Sobering, isn't it, when you lose people of your own age? You realise that perhaps you, as I was reminded, are a strong candidate for moving into a home. Sobering comment. But it's a serious issue, because you can ask anybody that. For example, I asked one of my grandsons, who's very technologically au fait with things, you know, can you type in, whatever method he used, what's the purpose of life? And although you can find out how many bones there are in the human body, which when you have grown up, there's 206, when you're a baby there's more, but 206 bones in the human body, but where does that get you? You can find out exactly where locations are of places. You can find out all sorts of things. But if you ask big questions, you know, what is the purpose of life? Do you know what the woman said on his iPhone? You've asked a very big question there. And a fortnight ago, I was at Morpeth, and the hotel that we stayed in before for a couple of days, it had got Alexa. Any of you heard of Alexa? Any of you? You right? Okay. What a load of rubbish, I thought. Anyway, I thought, well, I'll ask Alexa. So I said, Alexa, and this little disc answered the question, what is it? And so I said, what is the purpose of life? And she was more honest, said, I don't know. Interesting that, isn't it? But they're working on it, you know, they're constantly trying to update that bit of electronic guidance. Well, I'll tell you why I picked this subject. It's because last year I read a book that took 5 years to produce. It's been produced by, in fact, what's called the ALS, that doesn't affect you, but it took 5 years just over, and it's written by somebody I knew virtually before he was born, Mark Vincent, if any of you know him or know of him. I've had quite a bit of contact with him. He's got a very good brain, and he's very sound and sensible. And he wrote a book called, and some of you are aware of it, it's called Life's Big Questions. And the title is what it says, Life's Big Questions. And I thought it would be useful not just to pose life's big questions, but to look at the answers. And I'll talk more about that later. The point is that when you try to think of where did the world come from, there's lots of answers, aren't there? And a lot of you know it. Some say random accident. Some say that it is purposeful, so you've got two immediate opposites. Where did humans come from? What is the point of them existing? What is our place in the world? What is the future for society or individuals? What can we look forward to? And recently I've noticed quite a lot of people dying in their 80s and some reaching 90 now. 90 seems to be the new 70. When I was young, my grandmother was 70. She was like Victoria, you know, dressed old, acted old, walked around old, had daughters fussing around her and so on. And to me, she was ancient and she was 70. Frightening thought. But now, 90 is sort of in our civilization, as it were, that aspect, isn't it? Some places you can go to, and I had a big shock on my first of many trips to Africa, where I met this old brother, old Christadelphian. To find out he was only 5 years older than me, that he walked around with a stick and grey haired and beard and everything. And that was a shock to me. And in their culture, of course, by the age of 30-odd, you're a grandma. That's frightening. You know, 50-odd, you can be great-grandma. And a lot of them died in the 50s and 60s. It was an amazing age to reach. Quite surprised that. It really alters your perspective. So how thankful we have to be in our supposed civilization. Well, these questions about our society and about the future of the world aren't just incidental, are they? I've already mentioned Alexa and other places that you can go to get information. And I want to just tell you, again, something factual, which is perhaps a bit boring to some of you. In spite of appearances, I'm in my late 70s, so I can go back to my student engineering apprenticeship and mention over 60 years ago how we were very honoured as student apprentices to have a talk from the managing director of the company. And after he'd spoken, this was a telephone company, so we obviously were all into communications, and he got out of his pocket this thing that was thin as a human hair. This is 1958. And he said, "Do you know what this is?" None of us did, all these clever lads that knew everything at that age. We didn't know what it was. And he said, "It is glass fibre." And he said, "We are experimenting in our laboratories to make fibre optic." And he said, "Before you die, we shall be using these throughout the whole of the world to communicate." And his prediction was true, wasn't it? It took a long time to get it off the ground, you know. But it's interesting. But, of course, you can get a lot of information, can't you, down that little piece, which is thinner than human hair. In fact, you can get, and this is where some young folk here might even know what a telephone directory is. A lot of you do, but hopefully all do. Do you know how much information you can get down? All the information in 1 second contained with 90,000 telephone directories. So imagine this room full of 90,000 telephone directories, and down one fibre per second you can pass all that information. It's quite amazing, isn't it? Now, this is a powerful metaphor for the way in which we are swamped by data in today's society, as I've indicated to you already. We're almost drowning in it, aren't we? That the average newspaper today contains more information than a person in the 17th century would come across in the whole lifetime. Whole lifetime, 300 years ago. Just as much information as is in a newspaper. That's if you know what a daily newspaper is. And sometimes it feels too much, doesn't it? We get too much. There's opinions on this, there's experts on that, but not enough wisdom, I would say. But what do you really want to know? How much of it is actually useful? And I've explained already some of the things that you can think about. Get the facts about things, how far from so-and-so to so-and-so, or how many bones in the human body, and so on. And of course, the internet is great for trivia, isn't it? Getting lots of information about lots of things. But on the big issues, why am I here? Where did I come from? Where do I go? What's going to happen to me when I die? You don't get any information that's useful at all. You might get lots of information about the background of TV stars and so on, but that's it. Nothing relating to the past, present and future that really matters. So, let's think then very specifically. And this is where it is useful to think about, and I'll mention it now, and explain why I've picked on this. Some of you are old enough to remember, or hearing about, even if you didn't know any of their songs, Queen. Queen, not in Elizabeth or anybody before, but Queen. And Freddie Mercury, who I never met, was part of that. And he, not long before he died in the early 90s, wrote a song that said, "The show must go on." See if you can get the connections. He says, "Empty spaces, what are we living for? Abandoned places, I guess we know the score. On and on, does anybody know what we're looking for? Another hero, another mindless crime, behind the curtain in the pantomime." And he's reviewing it like Shakespeare did, all the world's a stage and pantomime principle. "Hold the line, does anybody want to take it anymore? But the show must go on." And this indicates a thinking person's realization that life is empty. And when we take the time to stop and think, we're driven by the fact that many people are confused. Ask anybody what the purpose of life is. He says, "It's a huge play, a farce, a pantomime, with no lasting significance. Whose show is it anyway? And in front of whom performing? Is it right that there's really no meaning to any of this? So the best thing you can hope for is chance." And he continues the song. "Whatever happens, I'll leave it all to chance. Another heartache, another failed romance. On and on, does anybody know what we're living for? I guess I'm learning, I must be warmer now. I'll soon be turning round the corner now. Outside the dawn is breaking, but inside, in the dark, I'm aching to be free." And that's really, in the last line, it captures the longing for something more, to be freed from the shackles of the inevitable show that everybody takes part in, that must be lived but cannot be fathomed. But is life really so absurd? Can we not do better than this? What do people do? A lot of people can't solve the problem of the purpose of life, so they indulge themselves in things. Things. Stuff, to use a phrase. And this is something that Mark Vincent, in his book, suggests. He comes out with a word called stuffication, which is people acquiring so much stuff that they almost choke on it. He says, "In an attempt to ignore the emptiness and the lingering questions of our existence, we fill our lives with many enjoyable activities, and some of them can perhaps do us good, making hay while the sun shines by indulging ourselves as much as we can." And so that's what a lot do, pleasure seek and so on and so forth. But then, surrounding themselves with all the things that they have not only as memories, but real things, is all part of this pursuit of pleasure and self-indulgence. And where does it get us? Well, you realise it's empty, don't you? Somebody said, there are two disappointments in life. One is not getting what you want, and the other is getting it. Some of you have already nodded before I got to the end of the statement there. You realised what I was going to say. Advertising tells us if only you just get this, that car, that handbag, that spa treatment, that lifestyle, that food, you'll be truly happy. And then it is happiness for a short time, and then bang, down to the old condition. In fact, there is, I am told, the psychologists have a name for this. It's called PPD. Any of you suffer from it? It means post-purchase depression. There's something new you can go to your doctor with. He might not even have heard of it. PPD, post-purchase depression. And some of us, I have fallen for this in the past and still do in a way, but nowhere near as much. And if you go back in time, down the civilizations, so-called, that have lived on the earth, all of us can end up pursuing this belief in pleasure as the highest good and mankind's proper aim. But it's so, so empty, isn't it? The Greeks worshipped that sort of thing, and in a different way, so did the Romans. But then for those people who realise that pleasure and stuff doesn't satisfy, they'll say, well, I'll try out more relationships. So they have more and more relationships. And does that get them any good? Well, it never completely fills our hearts, Mark Vincent says. Why? Because wonderful though these relationships are, they can bring great disappointments and have all kinds of shortcomings. But even if we make our children the centre of our lives, and all of us have met that, where everything of a parent revolves around just that one child, or partner, or even somebody senior, you can end up being cheated or disappointed, and you can lose them. And so it really does destroy what was your purpose of life. Although forging relationships is very good, and it brings joy and kindness to others, and it's certainly a central part of our purpose. But as we will see, says Mark, there's another aspect to our relationships which are critical. Now, years ago, I started looking at different nationalities and different cultures back in time. And all of them have one thing in common: the desire to worship something. In our society, pop stars, film stars, sports stars, yeah? What does it mean? Back in time, go back to some of the things you can see the idols of, or the gods that people worshipped thousands of years ago. Does that ring a bell? Inside every human being is the desire to worship something. Might be the boss of North Korea. Might be a Chinese boss. And if you're desperate, it could be Trump. But you know what I mean. The point is, as you have a stomach that presupposes the existence of food, so the desire to worship something presupposes that there is something to be worshipped. And that's where God reveals himself. This craving for eternity that we all have is solved by, a lot of you know, the message in the scriptures. Well, time's moving on, and what I want to do is to look at, before I come finally to Mark's book and comments about that, I want to look at our position. Now, we read from Luke chapter 1. Just before we go to that, I want to give you just a comment from the high priest of evolution, who is still alive, Richard Dawkins, who has a relative who's a Christadelphian, by the way. He said this: there is no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good. Nothing but pitiless indifference. That's what you have to look forward to as an atheist who believes in evolution. Isn't it sad? And C.S. Lewis, before he became interested in God and his way and so on, He said, life is a senseless contortion upon the face of idiotic matter. That really gets to you, that does. Isn't it tragic? To put the other side of the picture, and I've done it with young folk and colleagues at work, you know, if you take things in creation, some of you here have spoken on that subject and you've heard talks many times. That not only the eye, the ear, the hands, the feet, and the marvellous design. I'll tell you something I did in Sunday school. Get the young folk together, teenagers, they usually know a bit about the facts of life. In fact, they know more than they let the parents know. But the point is, ask the girls to write all the bits in the human body in order to produce the next generation. Ask the lads to produce all the bits on a chart and blackboard or something, all the bits needed in a man's body to produce the next generation. Them coming together, and that's the next generation. What's the probability of that happening by chance? The more facts you know that you can put into that column, the more impossible it is. That's just one example of the design. And the designer has to be there for all the things that we experience now. And that's where God tells us of his design, his plan, what he wants to achieve. I'm not going to look at them now, but you all know them. What is his mission statement, his plan? All the earth shall be filled with the glory of God. Numbers 14:21. Isaiah 11. The earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. And repeated in Habakkuk, the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord, the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. And how is that to be achieved? One simple answer, Jesus Christ. The reading we had in Luke, we remember the announcement. People will be reading this lots of times in 3 months' time, won't they? And they're saying about Jesus, you shall conceive in your womb, said the angel. You shall call his name Jesus. Verse 32, he shall be great and be called the Son of the Most High. And the Lord God will give him the throne of his father David. And he will reign over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom will be no end. Ask people at Christmas time, although Christ wasn't born at Christmas, he was born probably September. But forget that, don't worry. Cash in on it to tell people about God and his plan. Ask people, why was Jesus born? Everybody goes on about the birth of Jesus, which is good that they remember that bit. But ask them why he was born. You can tell them, can't you? Here it is in Luke. To be king, yeah, over God's kingdom on earth forever. That's why Jesus was born. People ignore that. So sad, isn't it? Yet that's important. Incidentally, I've come across two or three bits of information which you might find interesting, and that is, thinking of kingdoms, heard of Alexander the Great, Caesar, Charlemagne, Napoleon, and this is what he wrote about them. He said, on what do these Alexander, Caesar, Charlemagne and other emperors, on what do their creations depend? Upon force. And Napoleon wrote, Jesus founded his empire upon love. And to this very day, millions would die for him. Tolstoy, who wrote the book Nobody Reads, he said this, with its doctrines of humility, of forgiveness, of love, it is incompatible with the state. And he was meaning any state, whether it's democratic or dictatorial, with its haughtiness, its violence, its punishment, and its wars. So there's interesting comments from thinkers of the past. If you want to talk of somebody of the present, who hasn't heard of Richard Branson? And I've got an article here that was written about him after a serious interview. And he, of course, is a billionaire, and he has a home on an island in the Caribbean, I think it is. And he wrote, and the title of the article was this. This was his big thing in life. I can see flamingos flying by. As he can sit there, looking out to sea, and so on, from anywhere on his little island, What's the main thing? I can see flamingos flying by. Doesn't that really sum up how pathetic it is? And if you think you'd like to have lots of money and be rich, if you get to be a millionaire, then you know, you want to have more and so on, and you can become a billionaire, and then what? I laboured not to be rich and I've succeeded, like a lot of you. But what is it, said this serious interviewer, about being rich? Billionaires, she was talking about. And she says, do you know this? They might have their private jets, their better teeth, their easier lives, servants do everything. But, she says, the rich have very few friends and much less fun on their summer holidays. That's interesting, isn't it? And if they all go and invited to somebody's island, they don't go and join and go in their aircraft. They all go in their own aircraft because they might get called away, or they might not want to arrive just on time and be the last to leave or the first to be there or something. It just shows how pathetic is life. Well, let's come finally, although I've got lots of other scripture quotes to mention, which a lot of you hear from here many times, but I thought I'd try and put a new light on it. Let me explain the source of some of this information. Now, books have played a big part in my life. I admit to reading this one twice. It's Life's Biggest Questions. It came out last year, as I've said, written by Mark Vincent, who's in his 40s. And he was given the request to do a book explaining about life's big questions. But it isn't anybody can ask the big questions. Where did we come from? Why are we here? Where are we going? But he provides the answers. That's why I put that in my title. And for example, I find the book interesting at the beginning. The stuff I quoted from Fiber Optics is something from my experience, plus what Mark has actually picked up on and written about in here. And he looks at chance and compares that. He looks at success. And I've tried to summarise it in what I've told you so far. And I find at the back, the really interesting thing of all things, which you never normally look at in a book, are the appendices. And in the appendices, he says, the remarkable credentials of the Bible. And he says, seven unique features of the Bible. The world's bestseller, daring claims, unity and diversity, accuracy of preservation, survival of the Bible, and telling us about the future. And it's full of information like that. And how that you can read this and benefit from it. You can give it to your neighbours, friends. You can give it to brethren and sisters. And you can give it to lapsed Christadelphians. I've had success in that score as well. So it is a book. What I did, I don't want to be accused, as some of you remember me in the books, of pushing too much and selling too much, but I brought about 20 with me, for those who haven't seen it before or got it before. I've paid for them myself. If you can afford it, to spread out the costs, £2 each. If you can't, well, take it anyway. But particularly for giving to anybody who's not a Christadelphian, you can have them free of charge. So I'll put these when we're finished on the table at the front here on the front row, and please come and help yourselves to them. An unusual talk, I know, but I felt it would be useful to everybody. Thank you very much.